Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. When I was leaving what we call back in England Vicar Factory, they kind of churned us all out, I had to meet up with the man who was going to become my training vicar to consider my curacy. It's a bit like me meeting up with Brett before he came here. And I remember vividly being in his kitchen and his elder daughter strode in. It's the first time I hadn't even said hello. She just came straight into the kitchen. Absolutely ridiculous, she said. At youth group tonight, they said, being angry with someone is like murdering them. Well, this was my first encounter with Naomi. And in a sense, you might almost say it was her first proper encounter with the words of Jesus. Jesus is the one who, well, his words have such power that he drags Lazarus from the grave, out of the darkness and into the blinding light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And like those mornings when someone, unconscionably bright and full of good cheer, strides into the bedroom and flings open the curtains to let the sun in, often we may want to crawl back under the covers and hide. The words of Jesus are like that freezing cold shower that reminds us that actually we do have bodies. They're a wake-up call to reality. We are confronted with something we cannot avoid and how we need it, because perhaps more so than any generation, we have surrounded ourselves with layers of unreality, almost entirely cut off from the truth about the world and our existence in it. We are unaware. Technology, of course, is one of the most profound ways in which the human has always learned to separate themselves, to make a distance from creation. Just a simple hammer, of course, puts a gap between you and that which you're about to work on. We had Peter Rogers here this morning, and we had a brief conversation about working with wood and the difference between a small handsaw or a large saw, or a chainsaw. And of course, when you work with a chainsaw, you have no sense of the material with which you're working. It's as if the more complex the technology becomes, the greater the distance becomes between ourselves and the reality we inhabit. Well, on that note, just a week or so ago, there was a fascinating story about the English rugby team and their problem with technology. Be it as with all modern sports teams nowadays, they employ a coach for just about everything. And they have a coach for sight and vision, a South African lady. And she had thrown a metaphorical bucket over cold water for them. She said, you need to get off your smartphones. The ball handling skills and awareness of where other players are have eroded in the last 5 years. And you've started to use them all the time. She had noticed how this practice of using the smartphone seemed to be cutting down an awareness of the wider world around them. The water, it must be said, was even colder for the England rugby team than for most rugby teams, because their major sponsor is the UK's largest telecommunications provider. So I don't know what O2 are going to do about that. Anyway, it seems to have worked because they beat the Welsh today. Smartphones have two effects. They get us even further out of our bodies. We get so that we get less used to using them. Our eyes don't move, so small is the screen. And as we've all noticed when we meet people in the street, their capacity for diminishing our awareness of things and people around us is hardly to be overestimated. We see it all the time. And what's more, these effects are cumulative, and it's quite possible they may be irreversible. We're losing our awareness of surroundings, and for we modern people, that only compounds our disconnection from our existence. Think about it. Most of us grow nothing or little that we eat. We make little or nothing that we put to use in our daily life. We largely live in urban environments, totally man-made, and live surrounded by human artifacts. And within these environments, we live in what, historically speaking, is an almost total isolation from one another. cocooned in the convenience and comfort of an illusory existence, when reality does break in, we're ill-equipped to deal with it. So Naomi, my vicar's daughter, was being thoroughly modern as Jesus, through his word, crashed into her life. If you are angry with your brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. Indeed, the entirety of the Sermon on the Mount is this most profound assault on our senses, this wake-up call. Blessed are the who? The meek shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who mourn. And so it goes on. I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. You've heard that it was said of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult them, you'll be liable to the council. And if you say you fool, you'll be liable to the fire, hell of fire. Wake up, says Jesus. And it's such a shattering awakening that with the disciples, when the rich man turns away from Jesus, we're left asking, whom then can be saved? Over the last few months, from time to time, we've been pondering the reality of the Eucharist. What the reality which we're called to wake up to, that which we are sharing in these moments. This act of worship that is, if you like a mighty river, or even a river of fire flowing from heaven to earth, transforming, purging, transfiguring our existence. Are we waking up to that reality? Jesus wakes us up to the reality of fractured and broken lives and then urges us to live in the light of it. If you say you fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. So, when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, stop. Leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to them, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser. There's an urgency to Jesus' counsel. This is serious. Come to terms quickly. This is life and death. Don't treat it lightly. You're caught up in the something which you barely perceive, and yet which has eternal consequence. Sometimes I wonder if, as Anglicans, we are maybe as poorly equipped to handle this aspect of the reality as any other Christians. We have this treasure of the Eucharist, which is central to our worship, but there is something deep in our Anglican DNA which is not about having it, as it were, a shared identity. It's much more, or at least it has often been, about coming to do here to do our own private business with God. The essence of our relationships with one another and the significance of them with respect to the Eucharist has barely crossed our mind. Many of us, I know, balked when the peace was introduced into our worship. What, you have to shake hands with people before you come to the table? But how can we possibly approach the table except we are reconciled to one another? It's not that the Eucharist is a symbol of our life together, that the real things is the meals we share and all of that thing. Rather, it's the other way around. Everything else that we do sacramentally points to this sacrament, the reality of our life together, one bread, one cup, one body, which is why St. Paul is so, as it were, he goes for the Corinthians, because he says, you know, one says I follow Paul, one says I follow Apollos. You've all, he says, it's as if you haven't even got off first base. You are so happy to come along in separation. Indeed, as he follows the story on, it comes to a culmination in chapter 10 and 11 with that focus on the Eucharist and the division that there is amongst the people. And Paul has strong words. But this is why we have our liturgy. In part, we might answer this question, how can we approach the table? How can we be saved with regard to our confession that we use in 404 when we speak of sins of ignorance? I wonder, which sins are we ignorant of? Here's a wee picture. If you're terrified of spiders, now is the time to look away. What if the spider you killed in your home had spent his entire life thinking that you were his roommate? Ever thought about that? No, you only think about yourself. Well, that's funny and humorous, and of course, every creature has its right to its existence. But I think it's in a sense, emblematic of the wider disconnection that we have in our existence. I've spoken before about, for example, not living with the effects of the things that we buy. We don't live where the factories are, and we don't live where the pollution is, and we don't live in those places. We're disconnected. You see, we've lost the sense of our place within everything. And I think we, perhaps more than any, despite the fact that we have access to so much information, actually know less than many, many people who've gone before us. I was brought to my knees some months ago by the realization, as a modern Western person, I'd used my fair share of the world's resources by the time I was 20. And now I'm well on my way to my third time through. We have sinned in ignorance. And like God's ancient people, the Jews, we make provision for this in our liturgy. They through the sacrificial system, we through coming and asking for mercy and forgiveness, which those sins which through our blindness we have committed. As one or two folks know, I turned 55 this week. I think that puts me finally in that most widely despised category of human being, an old white man. As such, I am told I am responsible for the sins of the whole world. Yet I shouldn't complain, because from of old we've been told that in some sense we are all responsible, that our lives are woven together in a way that we can barely comprehend, that our actions have impacts that we hardly ever comprehend. We're all responsible. Jesus doesn't just take some of the sin upon himself, but that of the whole world, and takes it to the cross. If we are to be found in him, where shall we stand so that we might say, well, at least I'm not guilty of this or that or the other? Stand apart in judgment of others? But how then can we be found in Christ? To stand apart in the muck and the mess of human existence is not only a nonsense, it's to find ourselves separated from Jesus, who entered into the muck and the mess and went down to the lowest place, the meek, the mourning, the lowly and the humble. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members and for your whole body to throw into hell. When we wake up to this reality, we realize that in human terms our case is a hopeless one. And we have one of two options. Either we give in to despair, and it seems as so much of contemporary culture in various ways seems to have gone on a path of despair one way or another. Or in faith we cry out, Lord, have mercy. We cry out, Lord, have mercy in faith, for we realize our fragility. Waking up to those words of Jesus, we realize there is no place that we can stand. But more, we realize that we cry out to the one who from the cross cries out, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The freshness of that cold water, shocking to our bodies, is the reviving of our hearts and souls. It is the water of life. The brightness of the sun searing our eyes conveys the deepest warmth, the fiery, passionate love of God for his children, the objects of his sheer mercy. Amen. Thank you.